This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
It used to be the case that you had time to live and breathe, find out in your brain what your next creative adventure is or what your next meaningful thing is. I think people have stopped taking a breather, and the word personal brand has become important when that's just a BS word.
Yeah.
Your personal brand is not about this book. The book's done. Now you can work on what's changing within you so you can write something unique again.
Yeah, exactly. The reason I got into this business is I love the ideas. I love exploring ideas and writing about ideas. And I just found after a while that as long as I'm talking about subtle art all the damn time, I'm not looking for new ideas. My brain's not searching for new ideas.
What are you curious about?
I'm really kind of excited and fixated on this idea of hope and meaning right now.
What's the connection between hope and meaning?
We're developing so many extreme and polarized beliefs about so many different things. I think it creates a sense of disempowerment, hopelessness. I think there's kind of a widespread sense that everything's going to shit and there's nothing we can do about it. And neither of those two things are true. It's not going to shit and there is a lot we can do about it.
So excited. Once again, this is your second time on. Mark Manson, the author of one of my favorite books, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. Now, when you're on TV talking about this, are they allowed to say the word fuck because it's in the title?
They don't want me on TV because of the book and the title. It's funny because when I go to other countries, I get put on a bunch of TV shows. In the US, I don't think I've actually done any TV here.
Now, we have a lot of stuff to talk about. First off, we've talked already about your book. It's a great book.
Mm-hmm.
It stemmed from an article that went super viral called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And it really, you have a very kind of direct writing style. I feel like there's so much writing and BS, like self-development type writing out there that all has kind of the same generic style. It's not, you could tell they're not real writers or they're not saying something unique. You have a very unique style and you had something very direct and unique to say. And now it wasn't so unique, the message, like, of course, we shouldn't give
as many fucks
as we would, as you know, we would like to, or people think we should. But you had a very unique way of expressing it and how to go about incorporating that philosophy into your life. You notice I'm trying very hard not to say fuck too much. And the book, so I want to talk about other things.
Yeah.
But the book took off, like we talked right after the book came out. The book took off. It's still skyrocketing. Like it's one of the most highlighted books on Amazon, or the most, I don't know how they measure this, but on Amazon, whenever they, it's one of the most read books on Amazon every month.
Yeah, it's been.
Like they can see on Kindle how much people are actually reading it.
Yeah, it's been top two most read on Amazon basically since they started that chart. And then I think in 2017, it was the number three seller on all of Amazon.
And this is so important because as opposed to just like making a couple of appearances on the New York Times bestseller list or whatever, people are actually reading your book and getting helped by it. And what it also shows me is that people are not just reading it, they're also giving it to other people and sharing it.
It's word of mouth.
Yeah, it's not just telling people, like I think people market their book the wrong way. They say, oh, please buy my book. But the real key is to somehow write a book good enough that people share it. Not just buy it, but they share it. That's how a book gets to be a classic book.
Yeah. Yeah, I did PR and appearances and interviews for a year afterwards. And then at the 1 year anniversary, I was just like, it's like, okay, guys, I'm done. And then it's been another 6 or 7 months and it's like, it hasn't dropped.
I don't think
it'll be years. Probably.
I would say for my book, Choose Yourself, which came out in 1 month from today, it'll be 5 years. It'll be the 5th year anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably did the same thing. I did interviews and stuff for about a year. And then it kept going. And it's only, I'd say, slightly dropped off recently. But now Reinvent Yourself is usually in the top, you know, whatever for its categories. But how's your life changed since the book came out?
It's been weird, man. You know, I feel like success is it's one of those things where when we dream about success, we dream about like the slam dunks. We dream, if our dream is to be in the NBA or something, it's like we imagine ourselves hitting the game winning shot or whatever. And yeah, success, like you have those highlight moments, those moments of like intense joy, but what you miss is there's still a lot of just weird adjustment and weird kind of
like what?
Life experience in between.
And define success.
Well, anywhere from financial to having like a higher profile.
I would argue, I mean, financial success is great because it relieves the issues of how am I going to pay my rent? But you were already...
Yeah, I was fine.
Your website was successful. You were making a living. I think the having a higher profile, that could translate into so many different kinds of success, including financial, that's the more important one.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a weird adjustment. I think the way our mind works is that it lags, like our perception of ourself kind of like lags reality. And I think the book took off so quickly and to like such a high extent that it took me, my brain like a year to just realize like this was happening and this is who I was and oh shit, I can't afford to do that. And oh wait, I should say no to these people because I'm in a completely different situation now.
Like who have you had to say no to now?
Well, I think there's a weird thing that happens in careers like ours where, you know, when you're starting out, you have to say yes to everything.
Right.
Because you have no opportunities. You need to take advantage of everything given to you. And then that flips at some point. And you need to actually do the opposite. You need to start saying no to people because your time is valuable. And there's way more people who want your time or attention than you're able to give to. And then I think with kind of the meteoric rise of the book, like that's even gone to like the nth degree to where, I mean, there are people that I gladly did interviews with when the book came out that today I'm just like, I'm sorry. Like I'm working on a new book. I've got two other projects I'm signing the contracts for. Like I'm busy fucking constantly. I'm traveling all the time. Like I don't have time to do some of these other podcasts or website interviews and stuff that I used to. Yeah, it's just like you have to, but it took me a while to realize I needed to start saying that. I mean, and the other thing too, I mean, going even further, so like, again, like 3 years ago, 2 years ago, or like when my book came out, they flew me up to Canada and I did a bunch of like readings and stuff. That was great. I was so excited. I'm like, oh my God, like somebody's paying for me to go to Canada. Now it's like I'm getting invited to like Korea, Australia, Holland. And I'm like, I don't have time. I can't. And so I'm like in this bizarre position of things that I used to like stay up at night dreaming about 3 years ago, I actually have to say no to because it's not worth my time anymore.
So I think that could, we could almost envision that like a curve. Like yeah. In the very beginning, let's say the curve is on, I'm going to make a curve that looks like an upside down smile. And so on the left-hand side at the bottom, you're at the bottom of the curve. On the left-hand side is yes, on the right-hand side is no.
Yeah.
So on the left-hand side, the yes is equal to zero because no one's asking you to do things.
Yeah, right.
Then you start making your presence known, you start having something unique to say, and you'll start being asked to do more and more things.
Yeah.
So of course you say yes. I like when I was starting out, I wrote for anybody who asked me.
Yeah.
I went on every podcast. I would speak at every conference.
Yeah.
I would travel anywhere. And then you get in that middle point where success is just enough that the yeses start to turn into no's.
Yeah.
And you have to start saying no.
Yeah.
Because like, let's say someone says, hey, can you give a talk in Toronto? There's going to be 10,000 people there. I have to really think, well, that means I'll fly there the day before, I'll speak, and I'll usually fly back the day after that. So that's three whole days where I'm not writing or doing other things, not being creative. I'll speak for only an hour. 10,000 people sounds like a lot, but this podcast will be heard by so many more. I might as well just do another podcast and speak instead of speaking to 10,000 people. And it almost doesn't matter what they pay because...
And the other thing too is you're speaking those 10,000 people, but you're also one of like 30 speakers.
Right. So you don't have as much impact.
90% of the people in the room actually don't even really care that you're there. So it's one of those things that sounds great in theory, but then you go do it and you're like, wow, I'm actually my time's much more valuable if I'm just writing or podcasting.
Right. So kind of the first interesting point here is that people sometimes give blanket advice like, oh, the key to success is saying no or knowing when to say no. I think the key to success is more subtle, like say yes a lot.
Yeah.
Actually, step number one, get people to ask you to do something. Say yes a lot. And then you have to be more successful, to be like a really, like the greatest, you have to learn to say no.
Yeah.
That's later on in your career.
It's hard because I think it requires like the skill here. I mean, other than actually saying the yes, like some people have trouble saying yes and other people have trouble saying no. But I think part of the skill too is having that kind of an accurate self-perception of your own the value of your own time. You know, like I find that I lag behind with that. That I have a problem. I've consistently had a problem saying yes to too many things over the last few years. But then you end up in this weird situation where, I mean, there's all sorts of like psychological mess that comes along with that. You know, you start feeling guilty, or you're like, wow, am I an asshole for saying no to this stuff? Like, and you end up in kind of this, if you get far enough to the right side of that curve, you end up in kind of this bizarro land where you're saying no to things that, you know, all my friends would be like, are you fucking crazy?
Like what's an example? Like, have you said no to going on Oprah or hanging out with Barack Obama?
No.
That's what you're making it sound like.
No, because that would be worth it.
Right.
To give you an example, the book was number one in Korea. Always wanted to go to Korea, never been. My Korean publisher offered to fly me out, put me up for 2 weeks, pay for me to go like speak at all these different events, do a bunch of signings and stuff. And I'm like, this sounds amazing, but I just don't have time. Like I know if I do that, that's 2 weeks that I'm not writing. It's probably another week, you know, it's another 3 or 4 days on each side of that trip that I'm like jet lagged or preparing,
right.
You know, so I'm losing basically like a month of work.
So I think what I'm getting out of that is, you have to come up with a formula for how much realistically, how much time something's going to take.
Yeah.
And you have to value that time somehow. And it's not as simple as like, I'm worth this per hour, because money is actually not the determinant. It's other things like, are you improving your creativity? Are you doing other activities that will fulfill your dreams later? So you have to come up with some formula for how much time it's going to take, what that time is worth, and whether that's, I don't know, somehow your inner compass has to be aligned with it.
Yeah, because if I start saying yes to that, then I'm going to start saying yes to all these other trips. And yeah, the other thing that kind of started happening too, and this is also going to sound a little bit crazy, but I hit, one of the reasons I stopped doing all press for the book was I started to get sick of it, because it became everything I did professionally. So I've been writing, I've been blogging for 10 years. I've done tons of other projects. I've been making money online for a long time. And I'm proud of all that. And I'm very proud of Subtle Art, but it became, for basically over a year straight, every single professional situation I was put in, all they wanted to talk about was Subtle Art. All they wanted to talk about, you know, they'd ask the same 5-10 questions. It'd be the same conversations over and over. And after like over a year of that, you know, I'm trying to get in a place where I can write my next book. I'm trying to find the ideas that are exciting for me for the next phase of my career. And so if I'm always being pulled back to the Subtle Art stuff, I started to find it to be strangely frustrating. And I don't want people to hear this and think that I'm like whining about myself. I'm just saying that there's these weird side effects that happen with, like, we never think about kind of the negative side effects of some of these things.
Well, and I think that also, what you're just saying, first off, I'll tell you why you're not whining. Because the book is still good whether or not you talk about it. Like, the book's done.
It's
not going to change whether you talk about it or not. People should just read the book because the book's a good book. Second, we're living in this modern age where there's this need to feel like if you don't keep pushing something or writing every single day, you're going to be forgotten about instantly.
Yeah.
And like, you know, let's just go back to the 1920s. Ernest Hemingway would write a book every 3 to 5 years. Like that, you know, Thomas Pynchon waited 20 years between books, it used to be the case that you had time to live and breathe. And like you say, find out in your brain what your next creative adventure is or what your next meaningful thing is. I think people have stopped taking a breather. And the word personal brand has become important when that's just a BS word.
Yeah.
Like, your personal brand is not about this book. The book's done. Now you can work on what is changing within you so you can write something unique again.
Yeah, exactly. Like the thing, the reason I got into this business is I love the ideas. I love exploring ideas and writing about ideas. And I just found after a while that as long as I'm talking about subtle art all the damn time, my brain, I'm not looking for new ideas. My brain's not searching for new ideas.
That's so interesting. I think I'm guilty of that a little bit, and I've been at times better and at times worse. But you know, I was writing about finance for many years, and then I started writing about, in this very vulnerable way, going broke and failure and how I bounced back. Mm-hmm. And I literally had hundreds and hundreds of stories about that I looked at from different viewpoints. But at some point, after you know so many articles, you know, there's only so many times I can write about, oh, well, this time I went broke and I did this. So, but I think I was afraid to break free because I saw how much it attracted people, that style. But I had to find other things.
Yeah, it's hard. And for me, I always try to straddle, you know, two areas. One is kind of like what people know me for and what people already enjoy that I've written. And then finding some new area that I'm very curious about or excited about.
Like, what are you... So, by the way, the reason I'm sometimes writing stuff down is because I'm taking notes. What are you curious about? What are you exploring that you haven't yet written about?
I'm really kind of excited and fixated on this idea of hope and meaning right now. I feel like we're living in a very interesting time in that everybody, like across the political spectrum, everybody seems to feel like the world is ending when objectively, like, things are pretty okay.
Well, have you ever have you seen Han Rosling's book Factfulness or Steven Pinker's book Enlightenment Now?
So yeah, I've read Steven Pinker's book. I haven't read Rosling's book.
So Rosling's book Factfulness, I think actually is better. I don't want to say it's better than Pinker's book. I think they're almost derivative of each other. I can't tell which one came first. But Bill Gates has tweeted out that Rosling's book is his all-time favorite book.
Yeah.
And it's filled with chart after chart after chart about how every single year the world is actually getting better.
Yeah. I mean, you look at on all these different material measurements and statistical measurements, like, yeah, we're better than ever. But what I find fascinating is this idea of that people seem disconnected from that. And I think people are always a little disconnected.
Yes.
Like, we tend to be very pessimistic and we idealize the past. But I think something's happening today in particular where, like, there are just overreactions to everything. Like, before we started this interview, we were talking about Michelle Wolf.
Yeah, the comedian.
And her bit at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And we, you know, you guys were talking about it. And you just within that, like, two-minute conversation, you guys mentioned that there were some articles saying that she was like this hero and savior that our country needs. And then there are other articles saying that like she was just this awful, horrible person. And I think political polarization gets a lot of attention now, but I think we're polarized about everything. And I think the side effect of that polarization from just the way information is shared everywhere is kind of this sense of hopelessness, is that everything is either just amazing or awful. And either way, it's like, it's out of your hands. You can't do anything about it.
You know, I think you're right, but I think it's also related to simply the algorithms in social media.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now on Facebook, you know, we all have too many friends, right?
Yeah.
So we all have friends beyond, almost everybody on Facebook has friends beyond the so-called Dunbar number, which is the number of friends your brain can legitimately handle, or acquaintances your brain can handle, which is about 150.
Yeah.
So you probably have 5,000 friends. I have 5,000 friends. Jay doing audio here has 20 friends, but no, So what happens is Facebook has to organize our feeds to the ones we engage with the most, and we only engage with the people who opinions agree with us most of the time. So we only see on, and we're all on social media for like an hour a day. We only see the opinions we agree with all day long. And so it's almost becomes wrong to disagree with somebody. And you see people, like I see people saying one thing and then another, they'll be coming, well, I guess I have to unfriend you now. Like it used to be the case, like F. Scott Fitzgerald in 1940 wrote a letter to his daughter where he specifically gave her advice, make sure you spend as much time as possible with people of differing opinions.
Yeah.
That's how you learn. Now it just doesn't happen. Like the opposite happens.
I definitely think the filter bubble is a thing. The other issue too, I think, is there's so much contradictory information. Like I remember I got on Facebook once and it was, I think I got on in the morning and I was scrolling and an article went by and I'm trying to remember what diet or nutrition thing. Let's say it was keto, just as an example. So I scroll by and it's like keto is the new best diet. You know, it saves lives and blah, blah, blah. So basically saying the keto diet is like the best thing since sliced bread. And I was like, okay. Not even like 5 minutes later, I'm scrolling down and it's like, keto will kill you. Keto is like the worst thing ever. And I feel like it's like this for everything. Everything that happens, it's like, it's whether it's political, like, you know, North Korea or whatever, it's, or some peace deal or some, the tax bill. It's like one, you read one thing, it says it's the best thing ever. And then like 5 minutes later, you're hit with another thing saying that it's the worst thing ever. And then 5 minutes later, you're hit with a thing saying that everybody's wrong and nobody understands it because actually this is the worst thing. And I think people just get confused. I know I do. And I know I just don't know what to think about anything anymore. And so I think when we kind of reach that state, our two reactions are either A, to just give up and just say, fuck it, I have no idea and I'm just not going to care anymore. Or B is to just take, like, pick a position and just like go all in on it.
Well, or there's a C, which I feel is the approach I've largely taken, not to brag about my approach, but
which is the best one ever, by the way.
Right, you have to follow this if you've been doing that. But I basically have, like, because it's so confusing, that's creates some stress for me, and I made a kind of conscious choice. I'm never going to have an opinion on anything.
Yeah.
So if I feel myself leaning towards an opinion on something, I just say, no, I'm not allowed. I like, it's like almost a form of minimalism. Like I just will not stock up on opinions.
Yeah.
Which could have consequences. Like I don't have opinions on things that are probably very important to people.
Yeah.
But it's not worth my time. I'm so focused on kind of doing what I can to be a good person, I'm just not going to waste time arguing or thinking about what's right or wrong about anything else.
Yeah, I think this is new. I think people checking out.
I don't necessarily think I've checked out because I still want to have impact.
Yeah.
Like I'm not like just hiding in my room, but I'm just not going to think about which diet is better or which, you know, approach to some way of living life is better.
Yeah. I think it's putting us, you know, I think if you look back over history, every form of media kind of has its, it affects us psychologically as a culture. You know, television, as great as it was, kind of made everybody sedated and passive. And I think the internet is having some of these like psychological effects on us in a really interesting way. And like I said, it kind of, the thing I'm reading about a lot right now is this idea of, because I think to be psychologically healthy and happy, we have to have a sense of meaning in our lives. We have to have a sense that we can affect something, that we have some purpose, that we have like some hope in our future. And as soon as you start losing that meaning and purpose and hope, people become depressed or they become incredibly anxious.
So what's the connection between hope and meaning? So basically you mentioned you're working on thinking about hope, thinking about meaning, and you went into this whole thing about how people's opinions are the same and also all the information's wrong. So what's the connection between that and hope and meaning? Like for someone listening to this who agrees with what we were just talking about, where does hope and meaning play a role?
I think the connection here is kind of what I'm starting to think, and this is just an idea, but what I'm starting to think is that the extreme polarization of information in the culture today is creating a widespread sense of hopelessness and meaninglessness. People either think Trump is going to save the world or that he's the next Hitler. Like, there's nobody. I personally am like semi indifferent towards Trump. I think he's just another mediocre president.
And the president, you know, doesn't have that much power.
Can't actually do that much. So right,
if you look at the Constitution, there's like, he can greet heads of state.
Yeah.
He can sign treaties. He can't pass a law. He can't even recommend laws to Congress. Yeah. He does it informally.
But the majority of the country has these extreme opinions of him. And it's not just him. It's everything. And I think as soon as you get pushed off into those extreme opinions, you start feeling disempowered. You know, because if Trump is the best thing that ever happened to the world, then it's like, what can I do? Well, no, I'm not going to do anything. Trump's going to do it. And if you think he's the worst thing that ever happened, you also feel disempowered. You're like, oh my God, the country and the world are going to shit. We're all screwed.
You think that is an excuse? So for instance, oh, he got elected. I'm just not even going to pay attention anymore to anything. Like, so now it's sort of like you're taking yourself off the need to make an impact.
No, I mean, I think the problem is there's too much attention. I think it's too much attention in too extreme of a form. And so I think because we're developing so many extreme and polarized beliefs about so many different things, I think it creates a sense of disempowerment and hopelessness. And I think if you look at like the rates of depression, anxiety disorders, suicide, like all these things, they're going up all over the developed world. Like all of the westernized developed countries, like all of those things are rising incredibly quickly. And so there seems to be kind of this epidemic of hopelessness going on in the modern world. And I find it very fascinating to think where is that coming from? And to me, it's if hopelessness is about how we perceive ourselves in the future, and the world in the future, then what is changing about how we see the future? You know, like I think there's kind of a widespread sense that, like I said, everything's going to shit and there's nothing we can do about it. And neither of those two things are true. It's not going to shit and there is a lot we can do about it. But the more we get disconnected from that, the more hopelessness we feel. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And then—
am I crazy?
What's the— so there's I could either unpack what all the things are that are making us feel disempowered. So you mentioned, for instance, politics, which, like you said, is either— you know, some part of the country thinks it's great, some part thinks it's hopeless. But then you throw on things like some people think global warming makes us even more hopeless, or I don't know, the fake news is making us even more hopeless. Yeah.
See, I think there's another facet of this too. So you mentioned the kind of the filter bubbles. I think that's definitely a big part of it. But there's another facet of this, is just that we're far more aware of all the problems in the world than we've ever been before. And so it just seems, so even though people like Pinker and Rosling have shown that the quantity of actual problems and violence in the world are at the lowest levels in history, but our awareness of those problems is at an all-time high. And so I think that contributes to it as well. So it's even though things are great, we're aware of so many ways the world is screwed up. And that just feels absolutely daunting and unbearable.
So obviously you've been thinking about this because you're also thinking of how you confront it and you're coming up with hope and meaning. How do you set your inner compass back on track?
Well, I mean, like I said, this is all still area that I'm exploring and reading about. But I think hope is something I'm really interested in right now, because I think one of the core functions of our psychology is to generate hope. Like, we basically generate these visions of ourselves in the future that we believe is going to be better. Anything from as simple as like, I'm going to get a raise next quarter, to I'm going to invent a cure for cancer, to I'm going to, you know, go out and picket for this cause.
And I guess hopelessness is, I'm never going to get a raise. I'm not good enough to meet a romantic partner. I'm not going to get rich for whatever reason.
And even if I do, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because everything's still going to suck.
So there's personal and macro.
Yeah.
Hopelessness.
Yeah. And I think it's very much tied to a perception of, you know, the world needs to be a better place because you were here. Like, I think we all fundamentally need to feel that in some way. Or else we fall into nihilism and lose any sense of purpose or meaning.
And I think also, even though I'm not a big believer in the power of positive thinking or the power of attraction or whatever it is, I do think if you feel hopeless, you're not going to seek out opportunities for yourself.
Yes,
you
know, 'cause absolutely.
Opportunities never are going to drop in your lap. You have to kind of seek them out.
Yep.
And you have to have, you like you say, hope is a vision of our future. You have to have some vision of the future that you're aiming for, not necessarily a goal that you have to have, because I think then you're setting yourself up for a disappointment, but you have to, you know, progress is perfection. You have to be making progress towards something and you need some hope to do that.
So if you think about it, you know, if you think about like my generation or your generation, things were much simpler. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have cell phones. We had like 10 channels. You know, for me, when I was growing up, it was very clear. It's like, hey, you do good in school and you go to college and like things are going to be great. So there was always kind of this clear next step for my life going forward. And I think today, if you're like a 15-year-old or even like a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old, it's not only there's no clear next step for you. And one of the reasons there's not a clear next step is because you're aware of how fucked. Sorry.
It's okay.
Okay. How fucked.
We've said it so many times. Yeah, you can't say sorry that time.
How fucked everything is in some way. It's like, you know, the college system is fucked and the corporate world is fucked and the government is fucked and like the environment is fucked. And so if you're a young person today looking like, okay, what's my next step? Like what, how am I going to contribute to the world? Like these, all of these things just seem so massive and out of your control that it's kind of like, whoa, why do anything?
Even innovation can make you feel hopeless. Like how many people, even Elon Musk has talked about this, that AI is basically going to destroy humanity.
Yeah.
So like AI right? being maybe, if AI succeeds according to what these people envision it as, which I don't believe it will, I think they have a science fiction version of what they think AI means. It's not going to make humans worthless.
Yeah.
So
I think tech is an interesting thing because I think a lot of people are channeling their hope in the tech. So not only people who work in tech, but also, you know, just lay people like us. Like I look at people like Musk and I'm like, okay, good. He's going to like take care of it. You know, like it's like, at least Elon's got it under control. But, I think, you know, what you just mentioned about AI brings up a really good point, which is that technology solves a lot of problems, but it also introduces new problems. So it's like the technologies that solved a lot of our logistical problems 100 years ago are now creating the environmental problems. So it's like the problems are never going to stop.
It doesn't also solve our inner personal problems.
Like, yeah.
Like you say, rates of depression and anxiety and are going up. So that's, so okay. So, not, I know you're still thinking about this, but just to be a little solution oriented.
I have no answers.
what are some ways to get
it's
hope?
It's all hopeless.
Maybe it is. I'm depressed now.
Some of the things I've been thinking about, one, you know, and you kind of alluded to it earlier. Like, I think one is getting way more locally focused. You know, I my brother works in politics, and one of the things that he always says to people is he says like people consistently underestimate both the importance of their local politics, but also how much influence they can have on their local. Like one person getting out there and like helping and campaigning for, you know, a state judge or a state representative or something, like you can swing, you can have influence.
Yeah, well, you know, we're talking in New York City and definitely. So I've lived in New York City forever, and definitely I would say quality of life in New York City is much more directly related to who's mayor than who's president.
Yeah.
So, and the quality of life locally in general just means quality of life.
Yes. Yes. And it doesn't have to be political. You know, it can be schools, volunteering, being a good neighbor, things like that. Like I'm another thing that I find very fascinating that is related to all this stuff that we're talking about is I feel like in 2016, the honeymoon period of the internet was over and a backlash began. I think the last few years, people have really kind of realized like, hey, wait, there's like a downside to all this technology. It could potentially be hurting us in certain ways. And I'm starting to even think like, I don't think knowing more about the world is ever a bad thing, but it's, I think devoting the majority of your attention to things that are outside of your control, I think is potentially, maybe we're discovering that that's not advantageous. Maybe I don't need to know about a terrorist attack in Germany or, you know, some famous person dying in Japan or something. Like maybe I'm actually better off like not hearing about these things.
And a lot of people, like I know where you're coming from because I mean, I've written articles about this. I don't read the news at all.
Yeah.
So somebody will come up to me, did you hear about X, Y, and Z?
Yeah.
Or even something small, like did you hear about what so-and-so said about this? And I won't know who so-and-so was. I won't know what this is. And yeah. I won't know what, you know, this is. And life's a lot less stressful that way. I think when you work on yourself, and again, I go hyper-local, like who can I help in my immediate environment?
Right.
That seems to me to give me the best satisfaction as opposed to knowing, like I don't know anything about what state leader is visiting Trump and how he insulted who and whatever
who he
happened.
Insulted this
but,
morning.
But everybody reads about this stuff. It's like the biggest gossip column in the world.
Yeah, I've very publicly, because I get emailed and asked about Trump. Like people want me to write about Trump all the time. And pretty much all I've said is like, stop reading about Trump.
Yeah.
You know, like it's 90% of the shit that's written about him is inconsequential and it's not helping anything. Whether it's pro-Trump or anti-Trump, it's not helping anything.
And also like I had one friend, a good friend who had a very popular podcast, still does, fortunately. And he stopped his podcast when Trump got elected because he said, I'm so depressed about Trump getting elected, I'm not going to do my podcast anymore.
Yeah.
And again, I'm politically similar to you. Like, I don't even think about any of these issues. But I wrote to him and said, if you truly feel that way, what's a better world? Trump with your podcast in it or Trump without your podcast in it? That's the one thing you actually get to choose. So he restarted his podcast again, fortunately.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, like how can we, so maybe devoting less attention to things outside of our control and sort of deciding what's outside of our control. Because we also have a misconception about what's in our control, I think. I think we rationalize, oh, well, it's very important for me to learn about it so I can convince other people to have my way of thinking.
Yeah. And it, I think, so I envy you in some ways. I've tried to stop reading news. I have this like horrible like sense of whenever I stop reading news, I have this horrible sense of like civic response. I'm like, I'm lucky enough to live in a democracy, so I need to engage to some extent. But actually one thing I started doing that was awesome was a friend recommended this to me is I started, the only place I got my news was if you go to the front page of Wikipedia, it says In the World Today.
That's smart.
Yeah. And it just lists the things that happened, the noteworthy things that happened. And then it's just a link to the Wikipedia article, which is always edited to like remove bias. That was really helpful.
So I do nothing except read books. Like I won't read, I'll read your articles online.
Yeah.
But I don't really read online. I don't go on my Facebook home. I'll go to my Facebook, my own timeline because it's professionally, and my own mentions on Twitter. I don't go to the Twitter feed. I don't go to the Facebook feed. I don't go to the Instagram feed.
Yeah.
All those things stress me out.
Yeah.
I don't watch news. I don't read news.
Yeah.
And I only read books that are recommended to me.
Yeah. I think this is going to be, it's funny. I've actually got a friend who's writing a book about this right now, but I think creating attention diets for ourselves is becoming a really big thing. I think in the next 5 years, it's going to be a huge topic. I think people are going to start talking about attention diets the same way they talk about like nutritional diets.
But that's still, let's just call it, that's a little bit nihilist in that, okay, we're going to deprive ourselves of something because it's not worth doing this. But what's some ways to increase hope? I agree doing things locally or hyper-locally is a good way. What's
I think doing things, spending more time with people face-to-face. I think one of the issues today is that people, well, one of two things. One is people overestimate the value of engaging online. So they think sitting on Facebook and arguing with somebody about politics for an hour is like actually useful. And then the other side of that is that people are escaping online. So they're playing tons of video games or they're watching YouTube all day or whatever. And I think it's there's all sorts of research and studies that show that like we engage face-to-face. I'm sure you've run into this podcasting. Like a podcast face-to-face is completely different than doing it on the phone.
Yeah, because only, I don't know if this percentage is correct, but somehow they've done studies, only 10% of communication is verbal.
Yeah.
So I don't exactly know what that means because it seems like we talk verbally.
Right.
But I would say the quality of my podcast went way up starting around 2 years ago when I would only do face-to-face.
Yeah.
The only non-face-to-face one I've done in the past 2 years was Richard Branson because...
Well, obviously. Richard Branson. Yeah. I mean, people underestimate how much of a calming effect that has and how much more rapport you get just from sitting in the same vicinity, looking at each other, having eye contact, things like that. I remember when I was younger, so I used to play a lot of video games when I was a teenager, and I used to compete in like tournaments and stuff.
Really?
Yeah. And so it was...
You're kind of a dork.
I was a huge dork. Still am. I have a laser kitten on my shirt, so that tells you everything you need to know. But it was funny. So I'd play these games. I was in college or whatever, and I just sit there and play games like all night. And players would just trash talk each other. It'd be like, "Man, you're garbage. You know, your mom is this, and I'm gonna kick your ass and whatever." And then you would go to the tournament, like, you know, and people would hate each other. Like, they couldn't stand each other. And then you would actually go to the tournament and see each other face to face. And you're like, he's all right. He's not such a bad guy.
That happened to me recently where I was getting a lot of hate on Twitter over something I had done.
Yeah.
And like, it was enormous. And it was all these anonymous people. And so, but it was really bothering me. There were some not anonymous people and some anonymous people.
Yeah.
And there were some people I knew. And so I was like, finally... This is 1 a.m. on a Saturday night, which just shows like I was actually,
yeah,
because I was paying attention to mentions of me,
yeah,
and it was 1 a.m. on a Saturday night. I was upset and more upset than I should have been. I regret this, but I put my number on Twitter and I said, if anyone really has a problem with me, call me right now. And from 1 to 5 a.m, I was getting calls from all over the world. And the first common response people were giving me was, "Oh, I didn't really expect you to answer." And then by the end of almost every single conversation was like, "Okay, cool.
You're a madman."
Yeah, I see your point.
You're an absolute madman. No, I would never have the courage to do
it. It was a mistake to do it, but it was interesting to see the response, have the experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
But okay, spending more time with people face to face.
Yeah. And then I think just doing something productive, and I think again, you know, preferably meshing this with something local, like going out and doing something productive. And it can...
What do you mean?
Yeah, it doesn't need to be... You don't need to go like build a house for a homeless person or something. But like, I think it's important to like develop skills. Like, find something that you want to get good at. Like one thing I've noticed talking to a lot of my readers, a lot of the readers who email me or contact me who are like struggling with depression or... feel like a lack of hope, don't have any clear vision of a future for themselves. I started asking them like, "Well, what do you do? How do you spend your time?" And most of them, they just work and then go home and like watch TV. And I'm like, "Well, what's your hobbies?" And they're like, "Well, I like to eat, you know?" And I'm like, I was like, "You need to like find like a skill, like crocheting, I don't know, origami, like whatever the hell. Like just find, like go learn something.
I always tell people, go to a bookstore and find a section where you could possibly imagine you would want to read every single book in that section. Because that's a good way to find out what you might be even slightly interested in.
Yeah.
Or I say, what were you interested in when you were 9 years old or 10 years old? And how has it grown?
Yeah.
So let's say you loved comic books.
Yeah.
Maybe you could be a writer. You know, there's so many places now, forums you could write and be, you know, a reviewer or write scripts or whatever it related to comic books.
Yeah. Because it's like, you know, let's say I take up painting or something, you know, it's suddenly, if I start doing it and I notice some improvement and I start reading some books about it, suddenly
you're excited.
I have some hope. I'm like, oh, if I keep working at this for the next 6 months, or if I work through this book or whatever, I can do paintings like this. And so that creates this sense of future expectation. And it's a reason to get out of bed and do something. So I think I think simplicity is kind of the answer. I think...
So do you think this will be... Oh, so actually, I'm sorry to interrupt. That sounds...
Yeah.
Simplicity.
I think.
What do you
mean? I think complex, like the... So the world has always been incredibly complex, way more complex than any single person can understand. But I think our awareness of the complexity is harming us psychologically. I think it's causing us to feel as though whatever we do is there's futility in it, you know, like there's.
So it's this is the what's that book? The Paradox of Choice.
Mm-hmm. Exactly,
Barry Schwartz.
Yeah.
So it's almost like you're saying now, information overload is also the paradox of choice.
I think so.
As opposed to just many choices. He was referring to many choices in the supermarket.
Yep.
But it's now also choices in terms of what information and media we consume.
Yeah, one way I described it in one of my articles is I mentioned the paradox of choice. I said, like, the more choices we have, the less we value each decision. And I said, it might be the same with information. Like, the more information we have, the less we value any given information. And this is why now you have people believing the earth is flat. Well, it's like, well, hell, it's like everything else is contradicted online. You know, vaccines don't work anymore. And I think it's maybe the way our brain just works is the more of something it has, the less we value it, the less we care about
it. It's interesting. You can find articles proving everything. I can probably
anything.
Find articles proving
anything.
The earth is flat.
Yes.
I can find articles on either side of vaccines, on either side of GMOs, on either side of climate change, on either side of politics.
Yeah. And the scary thing is that the more extreme and stupid it is, the more attention it gets. Because the internet is always sorting for extremity and like unexpectedness. That's always what gets the most attention. So the dumber the idea, the more attention it will get, and the more it kind of like lowers our standards of what information is worth accepting and paying attention to and what's not.
So this is give some good guidance on how to find hope, which is A, you know, focus on what you should maybe do an attention diet towards, kind of reduce complexity, find things to do that are productive in a local way, also find things to do that are productive for yourself, like I think in positive psychology, there's the concept of well-being, where one of the elements of well-being is every day having a sense of improvement at something.
Yeah.
And also your relationships, which you refer to as, you know, have more face-to-face time.
Yes.
That improves your relationships. And then there's a third concept of well-being, which is freedom, which is a little bit, I'm not quite sure what that means. But given that there is so much work on hope, and like, of course, there's classics on meaning, like Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. What do you hope? How are you going to add your unique voice to the mix? Which I'm acknowledging you have a very unique voice. So
yeah,
I'm curious.
I honestly don't know. I don't know. I mean, these are all themes that I'm kind of working on in the context of my next book. But the book is still so early in the process that I don't know what the conclusions are yet, and who knows, 6 months from now it could all be thrown out and I could be writing something completely different.
it's actually, I want to respect your time, and it's actually, we're going to start to wind up.
Yeah.
But you have a recent article, and actually, you haven't been publishing as many articles as usual.
Yeah.
And I learned from that, because my first, like, 7 years of writing outside of finance, I felt like I had to write every single day.
Yeah.
Or else people would forget me. It was like a panic.
Yeah.
So I have
yeah.
like literally 2,500 articles in my archive.
Jeez.
Most of which probably are not read or whatever.
Yeah. People,
so I don't know. What, like, your last one is April 5th, almost a month ago, which yeah. I really respect.
Yeah.
I don't think I could handle a month. how did you convince yourself to write less? And I guess
it was more out of necessity. For a couple reasons.
Do you feel like it's hurt you?
I think a month is a little much. I for a while I was doing 2 a month. For most of last year I did 2 a month. This year it's more 1 a month, and that's just because I'm busy with a bunch of other projects. And I've told my readership, I've told them, I've said, hey, look, first half of 2018 or so, you're going to get 1 a month because I'm working on all these other things. But yeah, I wound it down. Like back in the day, like 5-6 years ago, I was doing once or twice a week.
Yeah.
And I started to wind that down when I started working on Subtle Art. One, just because I found that if I was going to do good work on Subtle Art, I just didn't have the creative energy to like pump out a new article like every 3 days.
I mean, it sounds like you still do things every day.
Yes.
But not necessarily. So you're still working on impact every day.
Yes.
And I guess what happens is that compounds. And so what people remember anyway are the things you do that are impactful. They're not going to remember the quantity.
Yeah.
They're going to remember the one thing you did last month that had impact.
Well, and the thing I learned about the blog too, and especially the last few years, is that like one A+ article is worth 10 B articles.
And
so if I can just take my time and make sure I like hit a home run with one article, that's going to pay dividends for weeks or months.
And I think also, because there are so many forums to write in now that are open, like for instance, LinkedIn, I mean, I'm not blaming LinkedIn. Every forum is basically open now. Medium,
yeah.
Huffington Post, all these forums. It's people have to, they have to choose carefully where they're going to spend their time, what websites they're going to spend their time
yeah.
on. So you really need to give them something that they're going to share, or else they're just, there's no reason for them to just keep coming back to
yeah.
your site.
Well, and it's, and there's so, we've been talking about how there's just so much stuff out there that it's, I really think these days it's quality over quantity is wins the game.
So I want to just very quickly, it's 2:02. You okay for just 1 minute?
One more minute.
So the last article you wrote, I think is great. Six things people should give fewer fucks about.
Yes.
So like your last book is much more personal, like don't care about this, don't care about this, don't care
yeah.
about people's opinions about you. But these are interesting and it's worth thinking about and reading. We don't have to talk about them, but I'll just read off the things. Number one, mass shootings and terrorism. I think people would be shocked, and some people would be shocked that you say this, but you explained a little earlier why,
yeah.
you know, if we can't control these things, and sometimes we can, sometimes we can't, it's just worth thinking about.
Yeah.
And you relate
for,
this.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just rattle off one of the statistics I think I mentioned in there, which is that I think suicide kills more people in a day than all terrorism and mass shootings combined, like an entire year. Yet no, we're never talking about suicide or depression. So for me, it's not that mass shootings or terrorism doesn't matter. It's just that the constant hysteria every week or two that these things happen, I don't think is serving anybody.
Right. Like you had, Jocko Willink was on here the other day and he was talking about how 20 veterans a day kill themselves. And that's just veterans.
Yeah.
And there's not really anything being done about this problem.
It's crazy. Yeah.
And then the next one, there was a corollary there, which I thought was funny, the Kardashian rule. I'll save that for people reading it. Saving the children. And you talk about helicopter parenting.
I put a Carlin video in the middle of that one.
Right.
He had a great bit back in the day about fuck the children.
And, you know, not only that, Louis C.K. also has had a bit about it. Like,
yeah.
you know, what's up with you know, everybody having a peanut allergies. Maybe if we just look away for a year,
it'll take
then
care of
nobody
itself.
Will ever have peanut allergies again. Now, he was just kidding. He said his nephew had a peanut allergy. It's horrible, but it's just things to think. These are just things to think about. It's not like you're telling people don't pay attention at all. Steroids, I actually totally agree with you. We had Floyd Landis on. In every sport already.
Yeah, they're all doping.
Yeah.
They're all doping.
And it fools kids into thinking you can succeed at something honestly, when in fact, at some point when you've already devoted 20 years of your life, you realize, oh no, I have to now do this. And then you have to do something illegal.
Yeah.
And so, and look, Adderall makes people, kids dope in, on their AP exams. Like,
So doping. But it's, there's a blurry line there too.
Artificial intelligence killing people. We spoke about that. Like, definitely don't, people shouldn't care about that. Sexually transmitted infections. I'll let people read that one. And Trump, I'll let people read that one.
Yeah.
But it's worth also think, what I like about this article is just the exercise of thinking what you shouldn't care about and how much time these things take up in your life.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, you could be doing push-ups or reading a book, like a philosophy book or a math book or learning how to paint or whatever.
And again, I'm not, because I most of the emails I got criticizing that article, they were freaking out. They're like, well, we have to care about these. And again, I'm not saying we shouldn't care about these things. It's just that our reaction is very disproportional.
To our control.
Into the actual threat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, like the sexually transmitted infections, you know, I have a huge piece in my archive that I linked to on that article. Basically showing that, like, just like, the fear and paranoia around it, when you actually look at all the studies and the rates of transmissions and all these things, it's like 99% of people are going to be completely fine. You know, this is, you don't have to, like, lose your mind and go get tested every other week or whatever. So it's that sort of thing. It's the point of the article is mainly to just dial back the fear and hysteria on these subjects. Because I think in every case, the hysteria is hurting the cause, not helping it.
And also hurting your personal ability to have impact.
Yeah.
If your fears and misbelief that you might have control or impact on these situations is disproportionate to the actual impact you could have, you're wasting time.
Yeah.
So again, this is related to, that's time that could be spent figuring out how to find hope or meaning in your life or whatever. What's a good book people should read?
What's the best book I've read recently? Oh my God, I'm blanking.
I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, I know you are. I've been really getting into, like, philosophy lately. I started a little philosophy book club here in New York, and that's been a ton of fun. So we actually just read Plato's Republic. So that maybe that's why I'm, like, thinking about these, like, social, socio-political things so much. But I think my favorite book from that club was Gödel, Escher, and Bach. By Hofstadter.
You know, I haven't read that since I was a kid.
It's a mind bender.
What's the thing that you take out of that? Because I can't even remember now.
So the whole book is about paradox, which is just so cool. It's just how paradox shows up in, like, all these different parts of life. And then at the end of the book, he makes the argument that kind of the paradox of our mind is what creates consciousness. So he calls them strange loops. I won't explain it further. I'll leave it up to the listener to go explore it. It's a big book, but it's worth it. It's a lot of fun.
Well, Mark, I know you say no to a lot of things. Thanks once again for saying yes to coming on this podcast. You also mentioned, you know, towards the end of the year or early next year, you're going to be up to something big. Will you come on the podcast then?
I would love to.
Excellent. And we met playing poker. You want to play? Want to organize a poker game again? We'll get together. Excellent.
Sure.
Well, thanks a lot, Mark. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, James.